I'm Tracy Breton, a professor in the nonfiction writing program at Brown University, and we're on with Katrina Northrup, who just finished an internship during the summer at the New York Times Beijing Bureau, doing some reporting, and Andy Corbin, who's another one of my students at Brown, who just finished a summer at Channel 10, WJAR, doing some general assignment reporting. We're here to talk about this project that we did for the last year about elder abuse in Rhode Island. So I guess I should start by explaining how this project germinated. Mm-hmm. I got a phone call out of the blue in April of 2017 from Ben Eisler, who at that point was a graduate student at Columbia University Business School. And he asked me if I would run a pilot project for a nonprofit he was starting to jumpstart local investigative reporting using advanced college journalists. He had this idea that if you could pair advanced journalism students with seasoned journalists who are also journalism professors, that we could fill the gap in local investigative reporting by doing some meaty projects. I was a little hesitant to take this on, quite frankly, because it was going to be a very big project, and I had committed to writing a book that I'm under contract for, but I also felt so strongly that this was something that was very important to me. It's the reason I teach. I've been training a new generation of journalists for 21 years now at Brown, and I felt like this was a project that was too good to pass up.
And how did you settle on elder abuse?
I had had a fellowship through the Carter Center in Atlanta in 2006 and 2007, and did, while I was a reporter here at the Journal, did a series of stories on elder abuse, which is a topic that's been of interest to me since I was in high school when I was a volunteer in a nursing home. Actually, the project that you're seeing today is one that if I'd stayed at the Journal, I had hoped to do on my own. I wanted to do a computer-assisted reporting project that centered on how elder abuse was policed and prosecuted here in Rhode Island. And I already had about 100 court files that another student long ago had Xeroxed for me in preparation for doing that in my office at home. So I thought, Let's do this project, especially since we had an elder abuse unit here in the Attorney General's Department. It had been in existence since 2005, and I really wanted to see sort of what was happening with these cases. I mean, we'd had a series of laws passed over the years that had upped penalties for crimes against the elderly. It was an issue that had come to the forefront in some of the Attorney General campaigns that I covered. And so I thought it was interesting, you know, it would be of interest to see what was happening with these cases. So I chose four of my most advanced journalism students, called them all up and said, hey, do you want to do independent studies with me for course credit next semester? And we thought it was going to be a semester-long project. It turned into a year-long project. The nonprofit spent $2,000 buying data from the judiciary so we could do a computer-assisted reporting angle on the story as well as traditional reporting. And we basically spent months before we did any writing with the students in the state record centers and the courthouses combing through these files to see, you know, what the scope of elder abuse was and what was happening with these cases and whether any patterns emerged. And I'm going to let Katrina and Andy talk about their hunt for the story and why they decided to join the project and what they learned from it.
When we started out, we were just calling every police department in the state and basically getting their take on the issue and if it's present in their communities. And basically every call I was on, they were like, it isn't a big thing here, or maybe there's one or two cases a year. But what we wrote reading we were doing kind of showed that this was just really hard for police departments to follow through on, and it was a really interesting issue and a terrible injustice that's going on that no one was really digging into. So it was really inspiring and worthwhile for us to work on it. So the police department calls, and then we went on to, what, like Professor Breton was saying, just going through hundreds of case files on this in the state, which was like traditional reporting work that is kind of hard to experience when you're in college. So that was really fulfilling and a really good skill for us to learn. And then from there on, we kind of got to see the trends and what was going on with people not getting very lengthy or at all jail sentences for crimes that were really terrible and disturbing to, for us to read. Katrina, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, and going back to just the reason why we pulled all of those court files, even though that was very tedious work, was just to get all of the specific narratives. And I think that was one of the most powerful things to me, to be able to make those numbers into real stories and real faces. And it's really easy to say, you know, 1 in 10 elders are abused in some time in their lifetime. But then when you look at these stories of these sons physically abusing their fathers or taking huge amounts of money from older residents, it's kind of hard to ignore. So I think that's why we really needed to go into all those court files and see what was really happening. So that was really rewarding to all of us, I think, yeah.
And how did you balance the sort of the reading and research you were doing through data science and what the police were telling you and your role as sort of a student? There's sort of an inherent power imbalance there that I think must have been very challenging to overcome as a young reporter that's still in school.
We started right off. Yeah, go ahead, Katrina.
Okay, so I think that's where the computer-assisted reporting really helped us, because we were able to say to police officers, actually, this is a problem. And so we had the numbers to back us up, and that kind of counteracted the power dynamic that you're talking about. I don't know what you have to say, Andy, but...
Yeah, the same thing. Like, we started off with those police calls, and that power dynamic was, I thought, more apparent at the beginning because we didn't have the data to back it up. We just had this idea that we were going off of. And after reading all of these narratives and like feeling these stories and the terrible things that had been done to these elders, it was easier to come back and talk to people with more evidence.
I guess I would also add that I instructed the students right from the beginning to tell everybody that they were interviewing that this was a project that was going to be published, and that this wasn't just for a class, and this wasn't just, you know, my first journalism assignment as a student, that they were real reporters and that they should act like real reporters and that they should demand and push for information that they were entitled to. And I think spending so many weeks and months going through the court files gave them the ammunition, in addition to the data, to sit there and actually grill people about why things had happened the way they had. And I think also it was a very good lesson for them, and not just learning how to use court files, but how to take information that was in paper court files and turn that information into real stories, because a lot of the people that they wrote about here are now either deceased or very elderly, and you know, they weren't people that they were going to interview.
Yeah, for example, the sidebar that I wrote, which was about a guy named Von Gongolinski from Cranston, Rhode Island, he was dead when I started writing the story, and the victim of the elder abuse was also dead. So I was basically constructing and crafting my story from the court files and from any police reports and from people who had interacted with him and the case. So that was a really good, I had never done that before, so it was a really good lesson in how you create something that really you have no ability to talk to the people involved, but it's still a really important story.
Did either of you have sort of that aha moment where you transformed your reporting from that sort of student court going through the records to really bringing it to the police and the people you're talking to and knowing that you've got them sort of with the data, that the reporting that you've been doing?
Katrina, do you want to take that since I wasn't there that semester?
Yeah. So we did an interview at the very end of our reporting year with people in the elder abuse unit and people in the AG's office. And I think that for me was a big aha moment because they really, I mean, I credit a lot of the people in that unit for doing all that they can, but there is a lot more to be done. And I think we had a lot of evidence to say that there wasn't being enough done. And to see them kind of react to that and try to cover their tracks was interesting to me. And I think all of us in that room that day were really excited by the fact that we had found this real problem and were talking to the people that were directly responsible for addressing that problem, and they really had nothing to say back to us. So that was incredibly exciting to me and to Jack and Rebecca, who were also in the room that day.
And I guess I would just like to add that as a teacher, the thing that pleased me so much was that we were meeting on this project every single week for a couple of hours. It was like a class. And we'd go around the room, like, what did you do? What are you finding? What are the patterns that you're seeing emerge? And maybe a month, month and a half into the project, as everybody was going through these hundreds of court files, I had already known from my own research and reporting that there were certain patterns to elder abuse, and you know, the type of person who was most likely to be a victim and the type of person who was most likely to be a perpetrator. And you know, they're all going around and they're all saying the same thing, that, you know, wow, what we're finding is that most of this abuse is happening within families, behind closed doors, and it's happening with grown children who have either mental health or substance abuse problems. And we're seeing this play out day after day going through these court files. The narratives are different, and maybe they're using different weapons, whether they be their hands or a knife or a gun, but that, you know, there were definite patterns, and that was backing up the scholarly research that had been done about this too. But you don't really learn about how this really affects people in your community until you see the faces of elder abuse in your community. And this is what the students were finding, I think.
That's really true. When we started, my conception was that this would be a lot of abuse going on in nursing homes or with caretakers who maybe weren't giving patients the treatment and care that they deserved, and that certainly existed, and we definitely read about that, but like Professor Breton just said, it was a lot of behind closed doors, family members, people with some sort of issue going for money or physical abuse and verbal abuse, and it just wasn't something that, you know, I knew it existed, but it wasn't something that I understood to be as prevalent as we found it to be.
Yeah.
It's also a crime that is kind of inconceivable. Going into it, I didn't, it's kind of like child abuse in the fact that these are people going after the most vulnerable in our population, and to me that seems impossible. But then when you actually start getting into it, it's so common, and I think that was also a big moment for all of us when we realized that this isn't just some weird fringe thing. It happens all the time, even though it's so horrible and we can't even really imagine it.
And also with how complicated and just like complex an issue to tackle, what we saw too was that since this abuse was coming from family members, a lot of times the victims wouldn't want to press charges because something horrible was going on, but it was by their child or someone else who was really close to them. And reading that was so heartbreaking because you understand the conflict there of not wanting to legally go after someone you love, but also having someone you love doing this terrible, terrible thing. So that was just another pattern in it that made it so heartbreaking and difficult of an issue.
And that's a particularly, you know, important problem here in Rhode Island, because we only have one place, and it's privately funded, it's not even publicly funded, where Adult Protective Services or the police can actually put somebody in temporary housing to separate them from a family member who might be an abuser. And what's happening in a lot of these cases, and it's reported in our stories, is that the police are saying, well, we don't really have a place to put these people to separate them permanently or to give them enough time to think about whether they want to be separated from their abuser. So they're kind of just, you know, like dumping them at hospital emergency rooms because there's no other place to take them. And I think, you know, one of the things that I hope comes out of this series is that lawmakers realize that they need to build a facility where they can put seniors who are at risk, who have no other place to go or don't have the funds to rent another apartment or hire somebody independently to take care of them. So many of these people not only don't want their loved ones prosecuted, but they remain with their abusers because they don't have the financial means to live somewhere else, and they have no other person to take care of them, and they can't drive, and many of them are immobile, and they're not getting the services that they could get if they were in some sort of a facility.
And so you have a lot of interviews and reading police reports, but you also did a substantial amount of research with data journalism and crunching numbers. And maybe that's an awesome buzzword in the industry right now, but not something I think a lot of people really understand what goes into that level of reporting and how that is. That's a very different kind of reporting. So maybe you can speak to both what you guys were doing and how you, as a teacher, it's very easy to make statistical errors that lead the reporting to something totally different, and you can speak to that as a teacher and then as students following that path.
Okay, well, I knew earlier in this project that, you know, I didn't have the computer skills to start doing data crunching and coding with very complicated coding and the raw material we bought from the judiciary. And actually, none of the students on my team have a deep computer science background. But I did have a student who took all of my classes at Brown, who graduated in 2017, who was a computer science concentrator, who loves, you know, I think his goal in life is to do data-driven journalism. And he's got a good computer job in New York and loves doing computer coding. And also Ben Eisler, who was the person who founded our nonprofit, who sponsored this project, had a roommate at Harvard when he was there as an undergraduate, who works for the Gates Foundation as a senior data scientist at the University of Washington. So both of them agreed to work with the data that we got from the courts to do the computer crunching. And so there were two sets of eyes on this, because I didn't want, you know, us to make mistakes in trying to filter this. And we spent months and months and months making sure that this data was correct. And, you know, there were several meetings back and forth with the people in the judiciary and making sure we got complete information, that we were purchasing everything that was there. And so there were two sets of eyes on the data, and they worked on that independently. And then once we had the number, I mean, we waited to write our first story in this package till the end of the project, because they were continually working with the data. And I gave them a set of questions that I wanted them to answer through their coding and the data, and that's how they did that. And the person who worked on that, who was my former student, is Asher Woodbury, and he's in New York City.
Yeah, like Professor Breton said, none of us were really computer science people, and I think like we kind of wished we were so that we could get our hands on the data and understand that aspect a little bit more. But when we got it and went through it, it was definitely confusing for us to look at, but it was also, you could see the trends and you could see the ideas that we'd had from combing through these files and from talking to people kind of solidified with hard numbers, with the data from the judiciary. So that was a really like satisfying thing for us to read through and to see more concretely laid out.
Great. So as you guys have gone out over the summer, you sounds like you've had really incredible opportunities. How has this project helped you sort of get the confidence to go out and, you know, plant your flag in other projects, other investigative work?
Katrina, you want to answer that? You were working for the New York Times in the Beijing Bureau, and you're a fluent Chinese language speaker?
I mean, I remember that when I was applying for the job at the Beijing Bureau, the guy that ended up hiring me said, the fact that you've combed through all of these court files is so impressive, because a lot of journalist students now just try to, not do any of the nitty-gritty work, and they just try to kind of skip the small steps. And so I think that those skills that I got from really digging in and doing all that nitty work really helped me this summer. I was doing a lot of combing through government documents and in Chinese, which is a little more challenging than reading English court documents. But so just having that background was really helpful for me. And it just definitely gave me the confidence to go and talk to people in a completely foreign country in China and try to get things out of them. And that also has, China has a political regime that's a lot more oppressive than the Rhode Island one. So that was another added challenge. And having the background and having the guidance from Tracy throughout the year really helped me be able to attack new challenges. And I know that it will continue to help me as I continue reporting and do other investigative projects.
Yeah, and just the plain reporting and interview skills have been really helpful, because these were interviews, like you were saying, with these figures of authority, and we were real reporters working on it. It wasn't for our class. It wasn't for a student paper. It was a lot more real than that, and as a reporter, I think that this gave me and gave all of us a lot of confidence and experience going into an interview and just leading the conversation with anyone, despite the fact that we're 21, 22 years old tops.
I think it
showed all of us that as long as you have the information and you have the details correct, then everyone will respect you. It doesn't really matter if you're 21 or if you're still a student, as long as you have something that is real and that has the opportunity to make a difference, then people will listen to you and really talk to you about any issue.
And I can only assume that Ben Eisler and the nonprofit you're working with are happy, and I'm wondering if we're going to get to see more work out of the sort of student-teacher collaboration at a Brown, or I know you've got your book that you've got to work on. So is this something we're going to see more of? Are you guys going to keep following up with elder abuse? Or are you looking at other topics?
Well, I think this group of students, at least one of them has left and has graduated and worked this summer at the Miami Herald. That's Rebecca. She's going on to work at NPR under a Kroc Fellowship this fall. The other students will be at Brown, and I'm sure are going to do some deeper reporting. I'm hoping that with the launch of this series that we can get some donations to Ben's nonprofit so that he can actually afford to fund more of these projects, both out of Brown, you know, with students working with me, and at other campuses around the country. I mean, this was a year-long labor of love on our part, and it does take money. I mean, we had to spend a couple $1,000s just to get the data from the judiciary for this project, and and you know, the students.
What is his nonprofit, in case anyone listening does want to contribute?
Okay, it's Community Tribune, and I think Alan Rosenberg in his column is giving the readers some information about that on how to donate. He is in the midst of applying for 501c3 status and is hoping that to start projects like this with other professors and students at campuses around the country. So I think it's a great learning experience for students. It's a great experience for journalists and journalism professors to work with young reporters, because I think as...
And can have a real impact on the community.
Yeah. And I mean, hopefully lead to change. That's what we're hoping this series does, and other potential series that other students and professors work on. So if you like what you see here, please support us.
Great. And that's everything I had. Did you guys have anything you'd wanted to add before we end?
I think that was most of it. But just to add on to that, this was an amazing experience for us as students and for the community members who I think were going to read this piece and have their eyes open to an issue they maybe weren't aware of or aware of the severity of. So this nonprofit and this organization has such a great mission that is helpful for so many different groups. So I hope it's something that can continue to grow.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming in. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about your series, and it's really excellent work, and I'm looking forward to reading it in the paper.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
This podcast is a production of the Providence Journal, online at providencejournal.com.